from the creators of Relevant Magazine, this is the Relevant Podcast.
Tuesday, February 18th, the year is 2020. You're listening to The Relevant Podcast. I'm your host, Tyler Huckabee. I'm coming at you from Nashville, Tennessee. Meanwhile, down there in Orlando, Florida, he is taking a break from his hard work, working down there in the Nevada caucus to come back and produce the podcast just for us.
He's almost got that tech issue soon. We're going to get some results any day now. So just chill out, Democratic voters.
He's been tweaking some of the nuts and bolts on the Shadow app, and they are good to go. He assures me that this is going to be a stunning success, a turnaround from the Iowa days. It's our illustrious producer, Chandler Strang.
Hello.
And up there in Loveland, Virginia, it's our friend Jesse Carey.
Hello, Chandler. I'm curious about your caucus app because for some reason Michael Dukakis has won the caucuses, and I don't know. I just am not fully trusting. the results, but hey, democracy.
And we are always happy to have with us back on the Relevant Podcast. Oh, he's got a new album out, and I've been listening to it all week. It is our friend John Mark McMillan. Hey, John Mark.
Hey, guys. How are you doing?
Good, man. Dude, congrats. The day has I feel like we've been talking about this for months now. The day has arrived. Peopled with Dreams dropped on Valentine's Day.
Yep.
What's it been like seeing the reception come in from fans?
It's been amazing, like really amazing. Like I think people really like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do too.
That's got to be a good feeling.
It is. I think you can feel it when people aren't connecting. You're like, maybe the internet's just different now. So I don't feel it. But this, I really feel it. Like, people are excited about it. And it's nice because you work real hard on something, you know, when you put it out. And you're like, I hope somebody likes it.
Yeah. Because there's kind of a sense, like, sometimes when you get some of the reception, even if it's positive, like, are they just saying that because they have to? Are they just trying to be nice to me? Which they don't. It's the internet. People obviously don't have to be nice.
No. Right. Not at all. But
my mentions show people don't feel any obligation to be nice if they disagree with something you're doing.
And John Mark, we talked about this before the album came out. And, you know, I think one thing that people might be connecting with, obviously the music is incredible, but just sort of like the vibe and the theme of it, kind of choosing to go in a direction that, you know, is kind of like, this album isn't like cynical. It's not like a deconstruction album. It's certainly thoughtful, but the approach is more, and maybe this is the wrong adjective, but it's more celebratory, it seems like, or at least more like I said, uncynical and more, you know, positive in a lot of ways than some of like the music that, you know, we've heard from a lot of artists these days that really focus on tough things and deconstruction. Yeah, you know, for maybe listeners who didn't hear kind of our last conversation, why did you want to take that approach? And was it kind of refreshing to be like, you know, I'm not going to be like cynical or focus on, you know, doubts, but really kind of lean into, like I said, that kind of like celebratory, you know, this is life. This is the moment. I want to express that, you know, like, do you think people are responding to that? And why did you want to take that approach?
Yeah, I totally think people are responding to that. I think I took that approach because I normally, when you're doing a record, you're thinking about, well, like, why do I deserve to have something out in the public? You know, like you know, like, and if I'm doing something someone else is doing, then it's sort of like, does it deserve to be out there? If everyone's doing the same thing, like, why do I need to do it? Maybe deserve isn't the word, but like, why do something if there's a bunch of people doing it? And I think subconsciously I'm always thinking about like, where is my like shelf? Where is my space? You know? And there's just so much cynicism right now that I thought it might be like nice to be offensively optimistic and see how people deal with that.
Yeah.
You know, this is so trendy to be angry and frustrated and cynical. And I can actually identify with all of that, but it just got a little bit boring to me, all the cynicism. Yeah. And I thought, like, this would be a real fun time to just totally flip the script. And there's some heavy elements, like lyrically, but I thought I could just lighten the mood a little bit around these heavy elements, and it might make things a little bit more exciting. You know, I'm not just so heavy. And
optimism can be its own form of protest, right?
Yeah, totally.
If it's done thoughtfully and its own with like an awareness of the realities of what you're protesting against by choosing optimism, that feels like a resistance in a way, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I, you know, like I really wanted to do something that brings people together, you know, and I think a lot of the problems we're facing, even as a nation, I feel like people think the answer is to make everyone like bend to your will. You know, it's like if we can just make the other side just bend, we're going to win. But I don't think people realize that it doesn't work like that. Like, I don't think one side is just going to get so powerful that they just destroy the other, you know? And if that happens, it has happened in history. It's not very pretty, you know?
And
I think it's actually more helpful if we can try really hard to see one another as human beings, you know? And so, without like giving anyone a pass, you know, I wanted to try and create a humanizing, it's a humanizing effort. I wanted to humanize people the best I could.
Well, you know? And that's a great thing about like the album and kind of art, you know, with that in mind, is like it creates an avenue for middle ground, right? Like,
yeah, totally.
You know, once you get too far off middle, there's a lot of things that a lot of people may, you know, the crazy thing is like there are tons of people, and I'm sure everyone's kind of interacted with individuals like this on social media from time to time, no matter what your kind of political or religious opinions are. Where if you were to sit down with that person and just ask them like a series of questions about kind of high level values, even stuff about faith, you would probably agree with the person on like 95% of things, you know, but it's that 5% that is like that dividing line. But you know what I mean? Like, oh, you voted this way, or, you know, you think this, or you think, you know, that really gets focused on. But I feel like art like this highlights that, you know, the middle of the good part of the middle of the Venn diagram, where, you know, we might, you know, there might be stuff on kind of the outer edges that we don't see eye to eye on, but man, we can kind of, there are still things that we can kind of celebrate together. Do you kind of, like, as an artist, do you feel any kind of responsibility ever to kind of create avenues for middle grounds like that, where people from a lot of different perspectives could come to your concert and enjoy this music because it's focused on kind of that non-cynical approach?
Maybe it feels like a responsibility. I think more like I've started to see it as something that I enjoy doing, you know. It's like, you know, it's just music in general is about connecting with people. I mean, just like the nature of music, like that's what music is essentially, you know, is you hear these sounds and you know, like if you're walking in nature, you hear nature sounds, you don't feel this like consciousness behind it. You know, but when you hear someone sing, you know, you know, there's a person connected to that. And I think that's why people listen to the radio. That's why people listen to music, is they're somehow connecting to other human beings. They feel less alone. That's why they play music in restaurants and in retail stores, because no one wants to be in a big store by themselves. It's very uncomfortable. And if they turn the music off, you get uncomfortable immediately because you realize exactly how alone you are in the store. You know, so they play music to make you feel like you're not alone. That's what music does, you know? And so like, I really enjoy that aspect of it, you know, figuring out how to make people feel connected to one another. And, you know,
it's interesting. I know this is sort of a tangent, but I think it goes to prove your point. We were in, my wife and I were in London over the New Year, and we went to this restaurant that she'd been quite excited about, that's very famous for its wine selection, and she's very into wine, so she wanted to go check that out. We went in, there's no music. They don't play music in there. So we sat down, and it's like, and everybody's talking like you're in a classroom, you know. It's kind of that like you feel like you're not even supposed, like, are we allowed to be in here or to say anything? And we asked about it, or like, there's no music. And they're like, yeah, it's part of our, they honestly, the servers seemed just as confused as we were by the choice. I don't know if this is a new thing they're trying, but they're like, yeah, it's kind of a vibe. We're trying out to encourage conversation. And
if you're a restaurateur out there considering this, it's a miss. That is not,
just the opposite. Everyone feels uncomfortable.
It is not conducive to conversation. And it's part of that is like societal conditioning, I'm sure. But I think part of it is what you're talking about, John Mark. It is that sense of music is such a communal feeling that really invites more conversation. Even if it's just background chatter, it is something that really opens up you this feeling of being community and we're part of something and there's things happening and there's life in the air and around us. And it is such a unifying thing. And instead, without it there, at least in this restaurant, I feel very aware of strangers around me.
Yeah.
And who are these people? Well, what are they doing?
Listen, here's a hot take. I'm going to have library people come at me and I don't care because like, I think libraries are like a great institution. Like I think they're fantastic, but I think they're very underutilized, right? Like real quick, show of hands around this table. When's the last time any of you guys have been to a public library? Like in the last year, have any of you gone?
Pretty recently. I go with some regularity.
John Mark?
I go a lot, actually, because there's a really great library by my house, but also because my kids, it's a really great free and safe place for my kids. So when I'm like losing it or it's raining outside, like I'll take them to the library and they will just go. And there's only one exit. So I know they're safe wherever they are in the library.
And worst case scenario, they're lost in the books. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're facing an unfriendly crowd maybe here, Jesse, but I'm not like a librarian.
Okay, so here's my take. I feel like a lot more people, especially in our generation, because I feel like it's like the libraries are now, and man, I don't care if I get arrested for this. Libraries now feel like they're made for little kids and super old people that are just looking for, it's the age margins of society of people just looking for something to do during the afternoon one day. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I think they would attract a little bit younger of a crowd if they would get, you know, if they would take some of these cues and try to make them more social, you know, like pump some music in, you know, even if it's like local music or something like, you know, people I feel like would not, I always get uncomfortable in libraries for that reason. Like, I feel like I'm walking on eggshells. Like I've been at the gym before, like a rec center where the music goes out and everyone's working out. And all of a sudden it just like, it goes from like this real social thing of like kind of nodding at people working out, just feeling good to everyone trying to disguise their grunts and heavy breath in the silence. So, you know, you just hear like, it just like the music's playing and it's just like top 40 and everyone's kind of doing their thing. And then all of a sudden it's just, like just, and it's like, okay, I get why they're playing music here, but I think libraries could benefit from the same thing. That's a rabbit trail and a tangent, but you know, like who's going to the library these days to actually just sit down and read a book? Like, if I want to read, I got plenty of places to read. This isn't like a, you know, detective movie from the early 90s where I'm going to look, I have to have silence where I look through microfilm from newspaper clippings from the 1950s to solve a long dead mystery. You know, I don't need the perfect silence. Like, I got plenty of play. I got a phone. I can read a book wherever I want. I want to go somewhere that's got some tunes playing where I feel connected with people in the community, you know?
But I think it would have to be the right kind of music if you're going to have if you're going to play music in a library, because it's not, there's a lot of music that I don't think would be suitable for the overall aesthetic of a library, for the energy of a library. And I don't know what kind you're like. I feel like even you couldn't just limit it to NPR. It'd have to be, I don't know if you could have lyrics. It may have to all be instrumental. Maybe Chandler.
Just
maybe
something.
We can start farming out some of Chandler songs.
It's just, and then the other thing, when you bring kids in a library, you feel like every person's cognizant of like, there's no place where you're quicker to be like, I don't know whose kid that is. And it's like your own flesh and blood. We're like, I don't know. That kid's really acting up. It's very inappropriate. We're in a library here, child. You know, like you'll disown your own kids in a library because they're humiliating you. Music would fix all of this. It would fix all of that. They need to play Peopled with Dreams in public libraries across America. Bring this country together again, you know? If we solve a lot of problems like that.
Well, it's not, John Mark, we do love you, but you are not the only musician we're bringing on to the podcast today. A little bit later on, we're going to be welcoming our friend Matt Redman to the podcast. Jesse, you get to talk to Matt a little bit. Later on, we're going to be doing a Twitter poll. John Mark, Matt Redman, cage fight, no holds barred. Who do you think think would win.
Two men in.
Hear them both today. You'll both get a chance to make your case for why you think you'd be the victor. And then we leave it in the hands of our Twitter. Chandler has promised to use his Shadow Cloud app to make sure that we get an accurate tally of the votes.
Two men enter, one man leave. John Mark, your weapon is a guitar. Matt Redman is coming with sharpened drumsticks. It's going to be
all right.
It's going to be ugly, but we have to. The producers demanded it. We need to inject a little drama into this season of the Relevant Podcast. This is what we got.
Yeah, cage matches. Before we started recording, the four of us were having a very interesting conversation about urban legends. Pre-internet urban legends, like stuff we all heard as kids, even though all four of us that are currently sitting around this table grew up in different parts of the country. And what we were kind of discussing for the listeners' benefit here is, you know, it makes sense to me that in the ecosystem of like a middle school, that a rumor would get around about something like, you know, we were talking about like how elementary school kids had, and I won't, people can Google it. I'm not going to, this is a family show, but like there's a food coloring yellow number 5 that every elementary school thought had the same misconception about the health consequences. We heard weird rumors about Marilyn Manson. I remember hearing a rumor as a kid that like, The thing that changed Pee Wee Herman, because remember when Pee Wee Herman got, you know, in trouble and there was those mug shots that went around and it was like, I can't believe that's what Pee Wee Herman. And they're like, you know what it is? This is what I heard when I was a kid. It's something with the bow tie in the suit that when he puts the bow tie in, it somehow changes his whole look. And as a kid, I'm like, I don't understand it, but you know, this seems, I didn't understand why Pee Wee was even arrested, you know? So anything they would have told me would have been. So later in the show, I want to, after we go through slices, during the feedback, I want to talk a little bit more about urban legends. So stay tuned for that too, because I have some thoughts about this and I think you guys do
urban
too.
Legend, urban legend, the middle school urban legend ecosystem in which they can just
Because kids today, you know, middle schoolers today, all are united by the internet, right? Like they all probably saw the same Instagram video or whatever, you know, but like but prior to that, how did these urban legends jump from school to school across the country? It makes no sense how this happened, you know, it's a curious thing, but I want to talk about it more later in the show during feedback. Okay, I think that's going to be your
theories.
Question of the week.
Come back to it. We'll table that for now. We got a lot to get to today. We this cage fight, John Mark needs to do limber up a little bit, needs to stretch
just
out.
make sure you go to a gym that has music, because otherwise it's just awkward grunting.
Otherwise it's
and
gonna
breathing
be weird.
That's all.
Nobody's gonna want to hear. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, time for slices.
Love is gonna slay us, love is gonna
listening to Unbroken Horses. That's by our guest today, John Mark McMillan. Beginning of the podcast, you heard Love of My Life by Summer Camp. Now it's time for our look back at some of our favorite stories that came across our desk this week. It's time for
Slices.
All right, Jesse, what do you got?
All right, I have two that I want to talk about. One is a video that went viral. We posted it over on relevantmagazine.com that people can go see it, but I'm going to describe it for people. And it is a video.
I hope it's the one I'm thinking of, because I think I wrote you in all caps about it.
You want to talk about unbridled hope for the future. And there's two anecdotes for cynicism for my challenge to listeners today. One is go listen to people with dreams. The other one is to go watch this video, and you will be very hopeful about the present and the future with both of those things. The video that I'm referring to was given to the world by the Crown Prince of Dubai. He posted it on his Instagram feed, which makes me very curious about what role the Crown Prince of Dubai, what it really is, other than just showing awesome stuff on Instagram. Like
if he's a prince,
He's a prince.
That's what princes do.
I've seen the Fast and Furious movie that took place in Dubai. A lot of it is just figuring out how to jump Ferraris from one skyscraper to the other. Like, we've all seen it. Okay, so this video shows a guy in like a motorcycle helmet and a very cool like leather suit. And he has strapped onto his back wings, like carbon fiber, just straight up wings, and some sort of like fuel. It's not like fire, but these big tanks that are shooting out some sort of gas or something. And he goes by Jet Man. Okay. What, first off, cool name. His real name is even cooler. His real name is Vice Refit. Okay. That's Jet Man's real name. If my name was Vice Refit, I wouldn't need to be called Jet Man. They're like, hey, dude, there's Vice Refit. Like, missed opportunity there, Vice. Your first name is Vice. That is cool enough. You don't need to be Jet Man. Anyway, so Jet Man is standing there with his carbon fiber wings on, with his like little fuel things. And he takes off from this platform over water. Okay, so he lifts off vertically. So he's like standing straight up, like moves forward with his little, you know, controllers. Like it's almost like he's got like Nintendo Wii controllers in his hand, you know, like two kind of joystick type of deals. He flies vertically over water. So he's like in the standing position. Then all of a sudden he goes horizontal. So now he is horizontal over the water and takes off into the sky and just flies at an incredible speed into like the skyline of Dubai. He eventually does some cool tricks as a big loop. The flight lasts like 3 minutes. All of a sudden a parachute open and he scoots down out of the sky. It's the most you know, when we were kids and we were promised all this cool innovation when we got older,
Back to the Future 2 type stuff.
We'd have hoverboards. Yeah. We'd have flying cars. We would like, look, man, if you would have shown me, you know, someone back in like the early 90s, like an iPhone, I'm sure they would have been pretty impressed. Right. But being able to touch a screen with your finger is objectively not as cool as a hoverboard. Okay. Like I think we can, or even self tying shoes. Like how can I
be downgraded on the promise?
I can FaceTime. I can FaceTime an individual anywhere on this planet and look at them in the eyes, but I still don't have high tops that will tie themselves. It just seems like a lot of empty promises, but this made me think, hey man, that this cool tech stuff isn't that far away. Did you guys see the Jetman video?
Yeah, I did. It's pretty impressive.
It is. It's hard to, if you haven't watched it, it's hard to, when you say that he zooms off at an incredible speed, it's really, that doesn't quite convey. It is like, he is going at, I have no idea how fast he's going, but he probably covers a solid, 1200 meters maybe in just a matter of
in
seconds.
A flash.
And then he goes over, it says he reached 1200 meters above the Dubai skyline before he did a loop. This video really changed me yesterday. It pulled me out of a funk. I haven't stopped thinking about it since. I watched it no less than, this is true, 24 times.
Yeah.
Because this is what, like you said, Jesse, this is what I was told was
this
in
was the
my
promise.
Future. This is what, and here this guy is out here just living it, just doing his thing. And it's not, you've seen hoverboards before where they have like the water thing where it's like it shoots water out of a hose attached to your back.
Cheating.
This is not that.
Yeah.
This is emphatically not a fancy hose. This is a actual jetpack, and he's very graceful on it. Now I'm sure there's been practice. I'm sure my first attempt at a jetpack will end in my death. But
what a way to go.
What are my options?
Yeah.
That's the one I want. That's the one I pick. I loved it.
John Mark, when your first impression when you saw Jet Man like fly out vertically and then just blast off into the skyline, what was your first thought?
My thought was, I've dreamed of this for years, and why is it a good idea? Like I think people are like, I guess just because you can do something, you should.
Yeah.
I thought, this is incredible, but like I don't think I thought when I was young, you know, when I was a kid growing up, that like, I don't think I realized that there's like no function for this that warrants the life-threatening danger that you put yourself into, you know, but I guess just to do it is worth it though. It's incredible. But I was just thinking about how dangerous it is and what function it actually accomplishes that's worth the danger.
Well, you know, the other part of this is this week, you know, Jeff Bezos is the richest human on the planet, from my understanding. I think he's worth somewhere in the neighborhood of like $130 billion. He, you know, obviously the owner of Amazon. Mm-hmm. And he pledged $10 billion to climate change. That's a lot of money.
Wow. I mean, 10 B. 10, yeah, 10, 10 billion.
10 large to fight climate change. Admirable. And I encourage that. I think it's a great thing. But if you're Jeff Bezos and you're like, I just gave away $10 billion, and guess what? I still have $120 billion. Like, and you see how easily you can part with 10, and it really doesn't make a difference. At what point are you like, I'm going to buy $10 billion worth of jetpacks and just randomly distribute them around the country? Like, if I had that kind of money, I think I would do insane. Like, nothing would stop me from watching these videos and be like, all right, I immediately need a bunch of jetpacks. You know, like, I don't know how guys like him have any restraint. Like, every video like this I saw, I would just start buying them up. So
Bezos also, since you bringing it up, he also this week set a record for the most money ever paid for a home in California. He bought a mansion in Beverly Hills, $165 million mansion, which is, that's a billionaire thing. That's billionaire, classic billionaire stuff. I get it. But I feel like billionaires are always buying new mansions, which is the most boring thing you could do as a billionaire.
Yeah.
Like, setting aside my own moral issues with it, which I have plenty of, and don't get me started.
All right, Bernie bro.
If you're gonna spend your money selfishly, a mansion, it's just a house. Everybody's got a house. It's a big house. It's a house, but more of it. You could be buying, we now know that instead of a jetpack, Jeff Bezos bought a house. This is what the idle rich do. This is why they should be voting for Bernie, so he can take their money away from them and do actually cool stuff with it, because this money is clearly rotting their brains.
No, here's the problem with billionaires. Not enough are just super, super weird. That's what we need more of.
Exactly. Elon Musk. Elon Musk is weird. I want weird energy in my billionaires.
Like, have you guys heard any interviews with Elon Musk?
Yes.
Just the famous one on the Rogan podcast.
Definitely. Yeah.
Okay, that's weird. He sounds like, he doesn't just sound like an alien that came to Earth that is trying to sound like what they think a billionaire would sound like. He sounds like an alien built a robot to try, you know what I mean? He is the perfect example. Like, if I was a billionaire, like, and I'm talking like real billionaire, like Bezos, you know, uh-huh. Elon Musk status.
Lots of money.
I would do what like Benny Hinn decided to do a long time ago in televangelism, is just create my own look. You know, when Benny Hinn started wearing like the Morpheus outfits, like he looked like, you know, when Benny Hinn decided he was going to start dressing like a televangelist from the future, like that's what I would do if I was a billionaire. I would have like this weird collarless blazer with my own, you know, Benny Hinn's emblem is like a dove, like embroidered on there. That's like, it's not 3/4 length. Like the length is oddly long, but not like long enough where it's like a trench coat. I would do that. I would just have my own style, my own weird tailored clothes. You know, I would go out there and be just a branded, and I would go by one name too. I would find like a one first name, just like Jetman, you know,
that would be easy. This is why I completely sympathize with Bruce Wayne. That's the billionaire energy I want to see more of in the world. He's got a lot of money. He decided to do something unique with it that only he can do. If you're a billionaire, find your Bruce Wayne thing. It doesn't have to be fighting crime as a bat. Oh, that's a good option. But you could be Jetman. You could go build skyscrapers on the moon. You could put trampolines over the ocean. Cool. It doesn't matter. Do something cool with it.
All right. So one more quick news story, guys. A neuroscientist this week has, you know, he did some pretty intense research, which involved talking to people all over the world for 2 decades, and tried to monitor when people, decided that they were most happy in life. At what age do you reach in your life peak happiness? And this is across the world, as he says, from Albania to Zimbabwe, 72 countries. He did this research, and he found the age where you reach peak happiness. All right, John Mark, I'm going to start with you. What do you think the age for the modern human adult is to reach peak happiness?
Oh, no, peak happiness. I don't know. Is it going to be like 23?
I'll say 23 is a very important time in the spectrum, but it is not actually peak happiness. Tyler, what is your guess?
I'm going to say later. I'm going to say maybe in your 50s somewhere. Let's say like 55.
Okay. Chandler, what is your guess?
I'll say 45.
Peak happiness. Well, you guys have all missed it by several decades, sadly. Happiness doesn't peak according to this, and I'll break down the research here because I find this really interesting. Happiness actually doesn't peak until the age, according to the research, of 82 years old. And there are a lot of reasons for this. Actually, what you're actually less happy when you're younger. Like you go through sort of these peaks, and there is a peak up at, there is sort of like your childhood peak. You hit 23. You have a lot of optimism about the future, but your 20s and 30s are actually some of the low points in happiness. And it actually takes at the age of about 54. Things take a pretty sharp upward turn. So the happiness curve is shaped like a U, actually. So you start as an upside, you know, so like you start off as a kid, you're pretty happy. Mm-hmm. And slowly as you get older, go through high school, gets lower, lower, lower. The bottom of the U is actually like in your 30s. It's not till early 50s that you picks back up and you reach back to your childhood level of happiness at the age of 82. And he had some interesting observations and research for why that is. Primarily, it has to do with your own, with people's own expectations, where a lot of times when you're in your 20s and 30s, when you're at the low point of that you. So with the implication is there is a hack here. There is a hack to make the you less, you know, less of a tall shape, like less of the curve, less of a dip. And that is because people, when they are younger, they actually have really high expectations for their life. And as those expectations seem to slip further and further out of reach, they become less and less happy. It's not till the person reaches their early 50s when they realize like, okay, this is probably what my life is, where it's not that they get complacent, but they actually realize contentment. And that rise in contentment actually continues all the way up into the 80s, all up into the way up until a person's 80s, because they're able to reflect on what their life was and where they are at the point with some sort of objectivity. You know, with this research in mind, does it, you know, and obviously it's probably doesn't change your guys' mind about anything, but are those results surprising? I mean, all of us on here are at the, you know, if you were to place us on this U curve, we would all be at the very low point right now. So
I feel that
is this research like surprising to you guys at all?
It's not really surprising to me. I threw out 23 just because it was a number, but I think I actually think it makes sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I would say that once you say it, that definitely tracks. And when you lay it out like that, it tracks because I think, I don't know, my 20s, especially, I feel generally speaking, happier now than I was in my 20s. My 20s were just, you're just so confused all the time and you don't know what anybody expects of you and you're just guessing and you got so many hormones that you just want to die. And then things do turn around as you like kind of grow up. And I feel, I would say, yeah, generally speaking, on a broad spectrum, I would say I feel, if not happier, then at least more aware of the expectations and the that are laid out in front of me. That makes sense.
So John Mark, you said you weren't surprised by it. And I think we may even kind of talk to an extent about, you know, the idea in the past episodes about how kind of ambitions can hinder our ability to be content. But do you ever, this is something that I feel like a lot of people in our generation or around our generation struggle with, particularly, I don't think like Instagram culture does anything to help this, but wrestle with the idea of the tension between contentment and complacency, right? Where, you know, sometimes, do you guys ever feel this, that people in our generation almost, you know, feel guilty for being content? Like, do you guys ever wrestle with that? Like, I should be unsettled. I shouldn't be complacent. I should be keep driving. I should hustle. I should do this. I should, like, do you guys ever wrestle with that tension between contentment and complacency?
I do. I think these days it's a little bit the other way around for me, though. I'm like, why am I not happy with my life? I mean, I am happy with my life, but when I'm unhappy, I'm like, why am I not happy? Like, I have pretty much everything that I want. And having traveled the world a good bit, like, I realized that, like, you know, most of us are doing insanely well, you know, even the ones of us who aren't doing great comparatively in the United States, like, we're still doing really, really well. So it's like, how much is enough? And then you reach that point where you're like, oh, maybe these two things aren't connected, you know?
Yeah.
And so sometimes I do sit around and think, why am I so ambitious? Like, I should be cool with the way things are, you know, like,
yeah.
And I have to tell myself two things. One is like, okay, it's okay to have a little bit of ambition. Just try and be responsible with it, you know? And the other is that, like, hey, don't get too weird. Like, life is good. You have food to eat, you know? And if you died tomorrow, you had a whole lot of fun. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's like even our conversation about libraries. It's like, I go to a library, I'm like, man, it's awkwardly quiet in here. Sure are a lot of books. And then there's just some old guy just sitting in the corner, like, just staring off. And I'm like, that guy's actually probably way more chill than I am. Like, he has no device. He just wandered in here and took a seat, and he's got nothing he's got to do this afternoon. That guy's got to figure it out. So yeah, I can understand the logic behind the research. Tyler, what do you got for us, man?
All right. I got two. We'll keep it quick here. First of all, we'll start with kind of a lighter one. I think listeners know that one of my favorite beats, one of my favorite storylines, is a really good grift or a con or a scheme. Yes. I live for those. Are just give them to me. I want to see how people are out there getting theirs. And I came across a good one from a couple weeks ago. So this comes to us from
stealing from public libraries, guys. You'll never get caught.
And I wanted to pitch you guys on this one, cause I think we could pull it off just ourselves. No, this comes from Atlanta. So in Atlanta, a couple weeks ago, over a weekend, multiple boutique hotels were visited by the Wu-Tang Clan in a Rolls-Royce Phantom, which had been rented from a national limousine. The first boutique hotel Wu went to, $60,000 were racked up in a room service. Then at the next one, $39,000 were paid. At the third boutique hotel that was called, and 10 rooms were rented out by the Wu-Tang Clan and their entourage, somebody on staff there got a little bit suspicious, put in a call to Roc Nation, who told them that the Wu-Tang Clan was not in Atlanta at the moment and had no plans to be so. What had actually happened was two guys had just said they were in the Wu-Tang Clan. They had found a few people, total strangers, told them to pose as bodyguards, started going around to the bars, getting everybody else to join them. Say, oh, we're with the Wu-Tang, we're hanging out with the Wu-Tang Clan. Were able to grift out of a Rolls Royce because of this, and started just going around partying in Atlanta, all on the fiction of telling people that they were part of the Wu-Tang Clan before they finally, the gig was up and the cops pulled them in, and they were arrested with $100,000 in unpaid bills that they'd racked up during this. Now, I love this story, and I do not obviously condone crime or lying or deception, but if you're not talking about that, I love the idea that you could, like, there are 9 people in the Wu-Tang Clan. I can't say for sure that I would know that if somebody came in here and told me they were in the Wu-Tang Clan, I'd be like, huh, it's possible, I guess. I don't know.
It's one of the ones I forgot about.
I know some of the main players in there, and they kind of shift members sometimes. So it's possible this could be a new one. It seems like that's a really solid hook to hang your grift on. And they got away with $100,000 worth of partying. There's going to be some jail time, I'm sure, but that's a small price to pay for a really great weekend, for rolling around like that. You juiced that for all it was worth. My question to you is, if you decided that you wanted to go, just go all the way, you wanted to go for it, what band is your grift band? Who do you feel like you could get away with saying, oh, I'm in these, and people would just like let you into the front door and start serving you up whatever you wanted, bottle service and the nice hotel rooms?
I think I would do someone that people know the name, but most people aren't, like, you know, I mean, there are a certain segment of person that could identify the person. I would grow my hair long and I would just tell people, oh, dude, I would spread the rumor. I'd be like, hey, Tame Impala's here. You know, like, everyone knows like the name Tame Impala, but I feel like, I mean, I can picture him. I've seen him live, but the same time, like most people, if you're like Tame Impala and it's like, well, there's a tallish white guy with long hair and a beard. Sure. That could be him. That could be him. I don't know. But he's got bottle service, so
I feel like Maroon 5 is one, is an easy one.
That's a great one.
Everyone knows the lead singer, but you could easily be the bass player or something.
A lot of those rock bands, you cut out the face of the lead singer and a picture of the band, and I am lost. One Republic. I guess that's a possibility. Coldplay.
Yeah, if you just walk into a boutique hell and be like a hotel and you're like, I'm the drummer for Coldplay, I'd be like, sure. All right, sure. I mean, good day. Good. Who knows? Yeah.
So I've actually done this before. And
what?
We do in airports. I used to tell my band guys, it's like, if you guys are up to no good, like, do not tell them you're in my band. Right? Like, if you guys are not up to no good, but it's like, if you guys just maybe whatever it is you're doing, think about whether or not how that reflects on me. And if you don't think it would reflect good, be another band. All right. Be another band.
I love that you have to have the talk with your band.
It's gotten better over the years. We're a lot more mature than we were when we were younger, but I think that for a while they were Katy Perry's band. So they're like, yeah, she's flying,
that's an easy one.
She doesn't fly commercial, but she's not taking us on the plane, you know? So they used to get free stuff all the time being in Katy Perry's band. Then the worst one ever, this is the worst story ever, is the band guys were Stone Temple Pilots one time. The guy came up, he's like, hey, because you're carrying guitars to the airport, right? And so some of my guys, you know, especially back in the day, are like, we're all black, skinny, long hair, and they look like they're in a band. Like, you guys, what band are you in? And the guy's like, just to whatever. They're like, yeah, we're in the Stone Temple Pilots. And the guy's like, oh, this is my brother's favorite band. Can we take a picture with you? And they're like, they didn't know what to do. And so he runs off to get his brother. And he comes around the corner pushing a wheelchair, right?
And
his brother is handicapped. And they didn't know what to do. Mentally handicapped as well. And they didn't know what to do, so they took the picture with him. And what do you do at that point? Do you say, I'm sorry, guys, we were lying. We're not really Stone Temple Pilots. Or do you take the picture with the kid and move on?
Yeah, so. I feel like you're in too deep at that point.
I know.
You're in too deep.
It was funny, like, until Scott it wasn't. Sots. Yeah. Maybe you guys should go back to being Katy Perry's band. I don't know.
Well, the great thing about doing Katy Perry's band is, one, I'm sure her band, you know, could be interchangeable and no one would, you know, they're like professional musicians. You know, I'm not disparaging Katy Perry's band. I'm sure they're great humans and great musicians. But also, Katy Perry's band is nobody's favorite band. Like, no one's going to be like, hey, I got to get a picture with Katy Perry's band. Like, that is not a picture anyone would, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Funny.
Okay.
Hard lesson learned.
The second story. This is we've been covering this and may continue to cover this. This has been a story that's been taking shape over the last week or so. Just wanted to get y'all's thoughts on it. Jesse, you and I discussed this a little bit yesterday, but this comes to us from down in Waco, Baylor University, where Caitlin Curtis gave a chapel speech last week. Caitlin Curtis, author, poet, storyteller. She is a member of the Potawatomi tribe, and she has been I've been a fan of hers on the sidelines for a while, and really appreciated her witness and the way that she really has incorporated her own identity as a member of an Indigenous people group into her conversations about Christianity and God. So she went down to Baylor and gave a chapel speech where she talked about, really talked about a lot of justice subject, about white supremacy. She talked a lot about feminism and the discrimination that women face in the church today. And of course, she talked about the fact of how much the land that they were currently on had been taken away from Native groups hundreds of years ago. And that's still an issue that's faced. It was a very compelling speech that's been posted at relevantmagazine.com. I would encourage you to go watch it. That was, it was, as you might expect as well, quite controversial with some members, including a student group, a Baylor student group called the Young Conservatives of Texas, took a lot of issue with what she said. They posted a whole statement about it on Twitter, taking issue with a few things. They really led with this, criticism that she had prayed. They said she had addressed her prayer to Mother Mystery in her speech. And in fact, they told reporters, a representative of the group named Jake Nieder told reporters, I mean, she didn't pray to God, and that's what's most offensive. So I dug into this a little bit yesterday. I watched her whole speech. I could not see any evidence in that speech that she addressed a prayer to Mother Mystery. There were two other chapel speeches. Baylor University, in a statement, said that they also could find no evidence of her referring to Mother Mystery. I reached out to the to Baylor Young Conservatives of Texas over Twitter. They said that they basically doubled down on their claim. They said, we've had several people confirm to us that they also heard her say that. Baylor has only posted footage from one service, so we have no way of confirming. If she did not say that, we would apologize for specifically highlighting that, but it was only one of her many problems. So I'm standing by what they said. Basically, there's a lot going on here, obviously. And there's been some chatter from both sides. There was an apology that was, an open apology written by a Baylor alumni who really thanked Caitlin for what she said and did apologize for how he viewed her treatment by some groups and alumni at the school. But it also just raises up a lot of the, a lot of touchy subjects that have continued to haunt the church over the past centuries, frankly, but have definitely become a little more divisive and hot button issues over the past couple of years.
And when we posted her full trailer, and Tyler, you and I talked about this a lot, I think that, the resistance to ideas that challenge our own, I think that's the most concerning element of this story, is that, just because there is a group of students at Baylor who may disagree or may have a different perspective than Caitlin does on some of these really important things that she talked about in the chapel service, that the response isn't to engage with those ideas, but it's to try to publicly discredit her, by fabricating things that she said, by threatening, you see this, sometimes people threaten boycotts or try to get, demand apologies. And it's like, what's the big deal? Like, she has a unique perspective that she's willing to share. That's a college. It's a place where people go to exchange ideas. What's the problem with, someone, saying things that, like, why is the response defense and outrage instead of like, oh, well, that's, mm-hmm. I may agree, I may not, but at least someone's kind of, challenging me here. Maybe I'm, even if I'm just getting a fresh perspective, I think that to me is the most concerning part. But it's not limited to this. You see it all the time, especially with Christians. Like, oh man, he said something I don't 100% agree with. So therefore, I'm no longer to buy his books or whatever anymore. It's like, why is that the response? It just that just seems so counterproductive to me,
I think so. I think that Baylor issued their own response saying that they kind of in their statement kind of implying that I think the words were veered off topic from the discussion over Twitter. She disputed that. But I think that that's, Jesse, I think the crux of it is really like college is a great time to be exposed to different ideas than what you grew up with and what you've decided on. It's there's such a easy safety net for you at that time, because there are so many people in college who are smarter than you, who are around, professors and even older students who you can go to and say, here's what I heard. Well, I don't know what to think about this, or this doesn't line up with what I was taught before. And it's a great time to be exposed to ideas that you don't agree with, and to be changed. Like, if you, that should be hopefully the reason you're going to college, is to learn things that you didn't know when you were in high school, which shouldn't be that there's a lot of things you don't know in high school. So yeah, I guess I would encourage people who when you encountered new and different ideas, to disagree with them or agree with them without saying, not only do I disagree with this, but it shouldn't be said, and people should apologize to me for saying it to me.
John Mark, you're an artist and someone who, you know, releases, you know, through your art, a lot of different ideas. And, you know, part of your audience is obviously kind of in the faith, you know, space. So is this something you've experienced too, where maybe you've written something or said something or released something that maybe isn't in alignment with all of what your audience thinks, and their reaction is less than supportive? Is this something that you experience, or something that is even concerns you?
Yeah, no.
In terms of like your own release,
it's definitely happened to me before. Like, I put out a song called No Country, which was, I wrote it and released it before the presidential election, right? But when it came out, the video came out like the week of the election. And I got accused by so many people of being like anti-America and anti-Trump, you know, at the time. And I'm not even going to get into that right now. But at the time, I was like, hey, guys, I wrote and recorded this song before the election. I was like, so you realize, like, if Hillary had won, you'd be accusing me of, you know, of being anti-Hillary. How do you think I did this like overnight? Like, you literally think like, after the election, like, I recorded and filmed this video and wrote, recorded and filmed this video and put it out. So I don't know, man. I think that people, and we're probably all like this, like, people tend to respond more to signals than they do to content. I mean, it's, you know, and so I think a lot of people just take the surface level words, you know, and they react to those words, and rarely do they ever dig in and try and understand what's actually being said. You know, the song was called No Country. So they thought, oh, I must be hating America. Cause I'm like, guys, don't you realize I'm a spiritual artist, and most of what I say is a metaphor for something else? Like, have you learned anything by now? If you're a fan, don't you realize that most of what I'm saying is like super layered and like is talking about something else? Like, so I don't know. Yeah. I have had that happen. And it is really interesting. Other times I thought I'm going to offend people with something I'm saying, but you signal correctly. This sounds really condescending. I don't mean it this way.
No, but I know what you mean. I know what you mean.
If you, like, most people are responding to signals, and this is what not knowing the depth of this particular situation, it's sort of like, it is interesting to me that they're responding to like Mother Mystery. But personification is something we do in literature all the time. You personify an idea to help you understand it, you know? Like, but I think it's really a redirection. It's sort of like, she's praying to Mother Mystery. That could be a way to talk about God for sure. I was like, but you're definitely like connecting. Your issue is with the signal. It's more than with the content because, you know, also people murdered men, women, and children in the name of God. You know, so like they use your correct name of God to murder these people, but she's maybe personifying a portion of God using a poetic literary device, and you're mad about that. It's, you know, but that's super common. People respond to the signal, you know, and it has more to do with their tribe and their affiliation than it does with the actual. I mean, I'm being a little heavy-handed here at this point. I'm being real overgeneralizing, but that's my take on it.
I think that's smart. And I think they kind of showed their cards to a degree in, you know, this group of Baylor students when they, you know, said, you know, once again, another liberal woke message or something along those lines, you know, and it's like, okay, so your problem isn't with the substance of what she was saying, you know, it's that she, you know, might in their minds represent a, you know, political affiliation that, you know, again, like you start layering on top of her message, all of, like you said, these sort of like these signals that, you know, overtake the message, not on her. That's not her fault. That's the fault of kind of not coming into something open minded, but certainly an interesting. And we've reached out to Caitlin, too, right? Tyler, try to get. Her comments, which hopefully we can bring people later.
I think that disagreement is really good in the faith sphere. I think that people debating that's as old as the church. That goes all the way back to the book of Genesis. People arguing about these things. It's healthy. It's helpful. It's good. It's just, I wish it could happen without the like attempts at censorship that it seems to come with a lot of the times and the need for apologies. So I appreciate your thoughts on that, John Mark. Those are helpful.
Yeah.
You must have, you clearly have some experience in this realm.
One time I got into it at an airport with Stone Temple Pilots and man, it was those guys, man.
Didn't even know any STP songs.
Yeah.
Unprofessional.
Interstate love song, man.
Well, that'll do it for this week's
Slices.
Stay tuned. When we come back, Matt Redman joins us. Listening to The Same Room by our guest today, Matt Redman. Matt is a worship artist and songwriter, and in his new album, Let There Be Wonder, he explores both the mystery and the reverence of God. Jesse, you recently spoke with Matt about the album and why he took the approach of exploring mystery and more. How did this conversation go? Matt's a fun one to talk to. He's so thoughtful.
Well, that's what immediately strikes you when you talk to Matt Redman, is how thoughtful he responds, not just to the questions, but really kind of like the heart of what I wanted to drill down to. He's really excited to talk about because he was very intentional with this album. This album, you know, we talked about mystery just a few minutes ago. This album deals with that idea. And I wanted to ask him specifically, like, you know, we're at a time where a lot of people sort of have this relationship with the concept of certainty that is kind of curious, where they're afraid of the things that they don't know. But really what Matt Redman wanted to do on this album was talk about wonder, talk about mystery, and you know, in light of how a lot of people, you know, really kind of value certainty, I wanted to ask him about that approach and why he wanted to instead talk about wonder.
That's a really interesting thing about, you know, this kind of leaning into a certainty, but maybe sometimes lacking something of the poetic and the mysterious and the wonder side of things. And actually, I think it's an essential ingredient in worship. I mean, it's a huge part of how we're made, isn't it, as humans. But also, it's you can't really have biblical worship without wonder. I would say you can adore someone without wonder. You can applaud them. You could admire them, appreciate them without wonder. You cannot worship without wonder. For worship really to be biblical worship, it has to have this element of the otherly. Like you are not like us. You are completely off the charts of anything we could fathom or imagine or comprehend. And of course, it's an easy thing to say, but it's a tougher thing to do. Particularly maybe in this day and age where things in society are into the familiar and the up close and the reality TV and the, you know, kicking mystery out of the equation. So in the face of sometimes culture going the other way, you have to fight for wonder and mystery and reverence to still have a look in when it comes to worship.
Huh. So a really interesting approach that he kind of wants to kind of break down, you know, make this album really centered on kind of the big things of God, maybe even the things of God that we don't necessarily know instead of just the ones that we do.
This is something that when I say thoughtful about Matt, it's, I'm not throwing shade on anybody here, but sometimes when you talk to some worship artists, when you hear some worship songs, you get the sense that it can it's kind of on autopilot. God does this. Awesome. He's awesome. And Matt always has a point. Matt is always thinking about something and he wants his songs to be about things, and that really shows through in this album.
Yeah, and for sure. And that's what I wanted to kind of also talk to him about, is how do you capture that idea of wonder in a worship song? And it's not just one song, it's really the intentionality of the whole album kind of points to these different ideas at different times, but it really kind of circles this concept of wonder and reverence and mystery. And here's Matt kind of talking about how he, you know, sought to capture that.
There's this funny thing as a songwriter where you can be a, you know, just a normal songwriter, and you're just whatever comes to you, wherever you're at emotionally, whatever you want to say, you can say. But when it comes to writing songs which you are intending to be sung by people in church, and it's a kind of fearful task in a way, because you're actually claiming that this is how you can talk to God and this is what God's like. And so one thing you're always doing is writing your songs and then reading scripture and hoping they can match as much as possible. You know, and I guess the thing is, sometimes you can be reading scripture and then you start singing a song and you feel like now we're singing like a God-like version. You know, this is the dumbed down, this is the simplified or diluted version. And so everything in you is trying to, like you say, it's kind of an impossible task, but it's something we have to at least reach for. I want somehow, in through the music, through the lyrics, to try and paint a big picture of God. And you know, the God who thunders and whispers, the God who terrifies and befriends, he's the lion and the lamb. He's the one whose footstool is the earth, and yet he knelt down and washed the feet off the earth, washed the earth off the feet of his disciples. This is the God we worship, and somehow trying to draw people into, yeah, that sense of wonder and mystery.
So, you know, you kind of heard in that answer, you know, these idea of like paradoxes, right? Mm-hmm. Where God is mighty and righteous, but he also, you know, values humility. And you look at the life of Jesus, and there's lots of these paradoxes. And that's something he worked really hard to kind of underscore in the album. And so I wanted to ask directly about that, because that seems like something that'd be challenging for me as a writer and a songwriter, mm-hmm. to make these paradoxes something that people can understand, but also make for powerful worship songs. And here's him talking about that.
I feel like the more you paint a backdrop of majesty, magnificence, mystery, holiness, reverence, you know, some of these big grand themes, and then onto that you project the cross or the Father heart of God, or the fact that, you know, in the New Testament Jesus calls his disciples friends, you know, and therefore calls us friends. If you can do both, then that's really where I was going to say where the magic's happening, but magic's not a good worship word. That's where the explosion of the soul is happening, you know. That's where, you know, how can it be that one is high and holy as him would have want anything to do with someone like me? And you know, I heard this quote, and it's kind of like a big theological mouthful, but these guys, Olson and Grentz, they wrote this book, 20th Century Theology, and they said in it, God is immanent within human experience as the transcendent mystery that cannot be comprehended in spite of his absolute nearness. And I guess what they were saying is, if you draw near to God, and when you draw near to him, what you find is like a tame, ordinary, domesticated form of God, that you're not as close as you like to think. When you draw near to God, yes, you'll sense his mercy more than ever. Yes, you'll sense his grace and his love and his kindness more than ever. But you also sense his holiness and his greatness and grandeur more than ever. And so I guess it worries me sometimes when we say we draw near to God, but all we're finding is this kind of very friendly version of God. That is an amazing part, the friendship of God. But when we draw near to him, we should also be burning up with his holiness.
The final question that I want people to hear his response to, and I was a little not nervous to ask him, but I didn't want to make it seem like I was talking about any one person or any one album, because I'm really not. But there are a lot of worship albums out there that, or a lot of worship songs where it talks about what God can do for us, you know, how God can, you know, be our deliverer, mm-hmm. our healer. And there's nothing wrong with those, right? Like, but they seem very focused on ourselves instead of putting, you know.
Sure, sure.
And this album is different. You know, I hope this hopefully doesn't sound cliched, but I think this is a very like vertically focused album. That makes sense to you, right, Tyler?
I know exactly what you mean. And I think that you're right that there's nothing wrong with what we'll call horizontally focused worship albums, as long as they're part of a diet. Like you don't want to get to, if you focus on just one thing, you're missing out on a really important part of how we relate to God.
But I wanted to ask, you know, Matt, directly, was your focus making something that was more sort of like from the vertical perspective of just, you know, kind of talking about God for who he is, you know, regardless of what he can do for us? And that really, you know, was sort of their intention going in. And he was excited to talk about that. And here's him discussing it.
I think we're in this danger sometimes where every song is about me and Jesus here and now, you know, and there's something wonderful about that. We worship the living God. We worship the God who we can know his presence. And we worship the God who we can, you know, have communion with and encounter and experience him. And so that's something really cool about that. But that can't be all that we're singing about. And I want us, you know, we're not just singing about the God of today and the God who is. We're singing about the God who was and is and is to come. We're singing about the God of yesterday, today, and forever. And what I've tried to do with some of these songs is make sure that we realize we're part of this grander story, this epic love drama with God. There's a whole wider scope to what we're caught up in here. And, you know, so I think in three songs on the album, All Praise and Upon Him and The Same Jesus, we talk about the return of Christ. And that's because it's a really important part of the story. Then, of course, tons of songs we talk about all that he's done in the past. And that's really my aim. Someone once explained it to me is these three elements of reenactment, realization, and anticipation. So reenactment, we're telling the old story. Realization, what does that story mean to us and me right here today? And then anticipation. This isn't even the end of the story. There's so much more to come. So I love that you've called the ALK. That's definitely what we were aiming for.
That was, you know, Matt Redman. We really appreciate his thoughts. Tyler, the album, which I've been listening to a lot along with John Mark's album, but it's Let There Be Wonder. It is out now.
Thanks a lot. And thanks, Matt, for joining us. That was Matt Redman. Up next, it's your feedback. You're listening to Be Afraid by Jason Isbell and the 400 Unit.
I tell people I'm part of Jason Isbell's 400 Unit.
There's 400 people.
Hotels.
There's 400 people in the band. How would they know?
How are they going to know? How are they going to know?
So last week, these are good. Last week, we asked you about a couple of things. Among them, your worst date stories for Valentine's Day. The worst dates you have been on. Here are a few of our favorites.
Okay. Adam said, I took a girl I'd been dating for a week as my date to a wedding 4 hours away. So he's been dating the girl for a week. They get in the car. When we got there, they drove the 4 hours. We learned that they came on the wrong day because Adam didn't look at the invitation closely enough. They ended up crashing the rehearsal. He didn't tell us what happened, what the outcome of the date was, but that's pretty embarrassing. But at least they got a good rehearsal dinner out of it, you know. But that does seem like things you'd want to check up on. I told this story before. It doesn't have to do with the date, but when I was a kid, my most embarrassing moment as a child, and I still remember this, how scarred I was. It was at elementary school Halloween party, and or at least that's what I thought it was, but it turned out that was later on the school calendar. I don't know where I was in third grade. This is my mom's fault, not mine, because I dress up to go to school event in a really cheesy homemade lion costume. Like, when I say homemade, I mean like fabric store, you know, like it was barely recognized as a lion. Like, it was just like, why is Jesse dressed so oddly in his face painted, like in those like weird earth tones? And it was like, guys, I'm a lion for the Halloween party. And I show up, I go to the auditorium, not a single person is
lion costume.
Wrong date, wrong event, and I'm the weirdo dressed in a homemade lion costume. So, Adam, we could see how those mistakes happen. Hey, Todd, why don't you read what happened to Jacob
here? Yeah, this is a good one. Okay, so Jacob says that back in college, he went to a Lecrae concert with a girl. At dinner, shortly before the concert, the girl got a call from her mom letting her know her grandfather had just passed away. He offered to reschedule and go another time, but she wanted to go to the concert. So, so it ended up being a fine date, it sounds like. Just a sort of the specter of death hanging over it the entire time.
Granddad would have wanted me to go see Lecrae and Auntie Minio. He would not want me to miss this. I don't know when they'll be in town again. All right, so
Jesse, can you read this? We have an update here, right?
Oh, well, I'll tell you what, let's do that. I want to get into the Indiana. I want to get into the pizza. Let's do our true crime investigation. Let's do PizzaGate next week. I want to do one thing before we go. We were talking earlier about because we need to do a question of the week. We need to ask listeners something, and I want listeners to tweet us, and we'll read feedback on the air. And so Chandler, here's this week's
editorial question of the week.
What urban legend, pre-internet urban legend, that they heard in, you know, middle school, junior high, elementary school, that seemed very odd but also plausible? And I want to read some because I want to see if people in other parts of the country had experienced this. We were talking about this before the show because, you know, John Mark, you and I, we grew up hours and hours from each other, right?
Yeah.
Yet we both heard the same weird rumors about Marilyn Manson, about Yellow Five, about Pee Wee Herman. Like, I want to know how these get from one school to the other without the benefit of the internet. What do you guys have any other weird rumors that you remember hearing as a kid that it just seemed like, well, yeah, every kid thought that. I heard that in real life, the band Stone Temple Pilots were real jerks if you meet them. That's what I heard. And I heard they're very ill behaved. They do a lot of crazy things in the airport. Chandler, what do you have any that you remember?
I feel like there was a lot around Pee Wee Herman, but I don't really remember any in particular. Yeah.
Pee-wee and Marilyn Manson. You mentioned Marilyn Manson, and I heard I heard a lot of that he had been in what show was he supposedly in?
Oh, the Wonder Years.
He was supposedly in Wonder Years.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, it's Paul or whatever the kid's name was from the Wonder Years. And it's like, and I just believed it to be true for a long time. Yeah. And it's like, no, it is not true at all. So listeners can tweet us at Relevant Podcast, the weird urban legends that, because we want to figure out how these got around pre-internet. It's every small town has them, and it's very, very weird that it happened. But I'm here for this. I want to hear other people's.
All right, I'm looking forward to I want to see how much overlap we get from those two. You know, like I want to see if everybody heard from coast to coast. Anybody heard the same or similar rumors.
Yeah, we want to know your pre-internet urban legends that you totally believe when you're a kid.
All right, many thanks to Matt Redman for joining us. His new album "Let There Be Wonder" is out now. Also, John Mark, thanks for joining us, man.
Yeah, thank you.
That was cool. Always cool when you're able to come along. You always bring a lot of wisdom to the podcast. You keep us grounded, John Mark, and I appreciate that.
It's when John Mark, when you're not on, it's almost unlistenable. I mean, it is just ramblings. It's just insane ramblings. People with Dreams out now, and you have a tour coming up, and it kicks off April, right, John Mark?
Yep. Mm-hmm. It does. Kicks off in April.
Don't tell Matt this, but I am rooting for you in the fight. I'm not supposed to have favorites. I'm supposed to stay objective, but you got my vote.
Hey, I know Matt, and he's scrappy. So
All right. Well,
he seems scrappy. Yeah. He seems like the type that would be like, where is he from? Like, what's his accent? Do you know John Mark?
He's English. I don't know what part of the UK he's from, but he's English. Yeah.
Because I knew it was English. I couldn't tell because I thought, is this New Zealand? But so it's English. He seems like the type that would be like, all right, mate, we'll start the fight in one sec. I just need to tie my shoe. And then he goes, ah! And he throws like sand in your eyes. And you're like, your shoes were tied the whole time. You know, that's.
So in your mind, he's not like one of those honorable British fighters. He's more like a Guy Ritchie from Snatch British fight.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. He's mixing it up. Yeah,
he's going to bring it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, good luck both. Good luck to both of you guys.
Well, thank you.
Hey, as long as you are all on our on the Apple Podcast page, go ahead and check out Relevant Daily. It's a podcast that comes at you Monday through Friday with the top three stories at the intersection of faith and culture we bring to you every week. And I think with that, we'll wrap it up. I'm Tyler Huckabee.
I'm Chandler Stream.
I'm Jesse Carey.
I'm John Mark McMillan.
Have a great week, everyone. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Relevant Podcast. If you like what you heard, be sure to leave us a review on iTunes. Check out other shows from the Relevant Podcast Network in the podcast section at relevantmagazine.com. And while you're there, browse exclusive podcast merchandise at our online store. Make sure to subscribe to Relevant Magazine. Info is available at relevantmagazine.com/subscribe. Relevant Podcast Network.